Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. The JAS Quintet plays Thelonious Monk in a few moments, but first, it's been a big week in South Dakota news and politics. The Dakota political junkies are here to sort through the headlines. Today, we have Denise Ross. Denise is an editor with the Black Hills Knowledge Network and South Dakota Dashboard. Denise Ross, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thank you, Lori.
Next, we are joined by Roger Whittle. Roger is a managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. Roger, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Roger, let's start with you. There's some significant news coming out of your neck of the woods today, the state's first case of tuberculosis. What do you know about that?
Well, this actually was diagnosed on Monday, so it was, I think, by default, the first case of the year. A gentleman who is now hospitalized in Sioux Falls was diagnosed with the tuberculosis disease, and now the State Department of Health takes these things very seriously, and they will begin testing people in the area who have had contact with this guy.
Is this something that's happened? Does it happen every year, or is this sort of a rare occurrence?
Well, it's rare in our part of the state. This is our first case since 2006, and I think we've only had one other one in the past 20 or 25 years. It's more common in larger population areas where there are more immigrant population, and on the reservations it's also a little more common. But it's really a difficult disease to acquire. I had a conversation with our state epidemiologist, Dr. Lon Keitlinger, earlier this week, and he was saying it's not like the influenza where you can shake hands with somebody and be infected. It takes prolonged close contact with people before you can pass the infection from one person to another. So there's not a panic going on or anything like that.
Sure. How are people reacting to it? Are people getting tested more frequently or vaccinated?
I hear that some people are in the process of getting tested and they're going to be tested later this week, but no, there has not been a huge uproar about it that I've heard anyway.
Denise, let's switch over to you and talk about this wheel tax in Pennington County. That vote was yesterday, correct?
That was yesterday. It was a 15% voter turnout, which, of course, is not great. But of those who did turn out, almost 60% voted no on the tax. And so that's not just an issue in Pennington County. I think it's an issue for the state legislature as well, because, of course, this is a construct passed under the big transportation bill that was passed in the legislature last session in 2015, and put this little hot potato in the county's lap. They've had this wheel tax option for decades. Most have been reluctant to impose it. Now the state legislature decided, you know, if you want to access this special fund that we've set up for bridge fund repair money, which many counties desperately need, you have to first impose your wheel tax, which is sort of max out your local effort first, and then the state will come in and with a little bit of incentive and match that money. As far as I know, we're at least the second county here in Pennington County to not support that wheel tax, which are rejected at the polls. And I think it happened also in Beadle County in the fall. And so now this is the beginning of a trend. Three is a trend. So one more, or maybe I'm forgetting one that maybe already happened. And you've got a trend in the legislature just getting ready to go into session, be very unlikely for them to open up this road bill again and tweak this. But I do think it's going to be a topic of some discussion. If voters start across the state to reject this wheel tax idea, suddenly the whole bill that they passed last session becomes weakened and it isn't working the way they envisioned it to work. So what they'll do in Pennington County, they said they may have to just raise property taxes. So we would still repair our roads and bridges here without the benefit of that extra state funding. You add on top of that, yesterday the county commission voted to increase their salaries by 20% for each commissioner, which is about $3,000 apiece. And while that's not a huge amount of money in the grand scheme of things, it definitely sends a message about what's going on at the county commission. And even if they deserve that raise and they're hardworking public servants, the timing just couldn't have been worse, I don't think.
So back to the wheel tax first, what are the voters saying? Are they saying they think that should not be a county responsibility, or are they just saying, in general, we don't want to be pinched anymore?
I think it's a combination of things. And the most interesting thing to me, I read a comment early this morning on the Rapid City Journal website on the story reporting this, talking about the scandals at the state level and the contracts, these sweetheart no-bid contracts that have been going and have been coming out over the last couple of years to different select people, very high-dollar contracts for the work that's being done as it appears on its face. And the comment was, maybe if you weren't handing out these no-bid contracts to your quote-unquote corrupt cronies, was the language used in this comment, maybe you'd have the money to pay for these road repairs. So it's a combination of the kind of reflexive anti-tax mentality that has been settling in over the last couple of decades, really, and this upset with what is being viewed as scandal at the state level. So I think it's more complicated than just, we don't like this wheel tax, we don't like the Pennington County Commission. I think there's a lot of factors going into this.
Roger, the Minnehaha County Commissioners also gave themselves a raise, and it was even higher. Is that right?
I believe I read that. Now I'm happy to say that the Cottington County Commissioners gave themselves a 2% raise just this week, which is the same level that every other county employee got.
So let's switch over to President Obama's executive order on guns, looking at gun control, gun violence, reducing gun violence in the country. How does this, or does it at all, affect South Dakota voters? Roger, you want to start with that?
Well, I think generally South Dakotans would be against increased gun laws, and it is showing in the number of people that have been running to apply for concealed weapons permits in the state recently. I think twice as many people have got those permits this or last December than they did the December before. And we're just skyrocketing those numbers. And from what our Secretary of State said, that she expects these numbers to keep going up as long as people feel that their Second Amendment rights are being threatened. And there's also some other issues going on, terrorism, mass shootings. Everybody feels they need to protect themselves. So that's kind of the basic effect it's having on South Dakota right now. As far as the long-term effect on gun ownership, I don't really see it having that big of an impact. We're talking about background checks at gun shows and things like that. So I'm not sure that the reaction people are having here is in line with what is actually going on with the laws.
Roger, do you think that's how another way that voters speak up? Are they kind of casting an unofficial vote by going to get a concealed carry permit to say, we're still here, we're still interested in this? Or is it just, I need this now and maybe I didn't need it before?
Well, I think it's a little of both. But I think as far as casting votes in that way, there's seldom any question on how South Dakotans are going to cast their vote. If you look at our voting records, we tend to vote Republican, and I don't think that'll change. So, it's a little bit of both.
Denise, do you want to add anything on to that conversation about President Obama's executive order and how it might affect South Dakotans?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Roger said. I think everything he said was right on point. I would just add that if you look at national polls, and I haven't seen polls at the state level, but national polls have shown that over 80% of Americans nearly as high percentage of NRA members support these background checks. And so I think the president felt like he was on pretty safe political ground in doing this executive order. And I just had the opportunity to speak with two gun owners in my own family, and I saw a man interviewed on Kello TV last night. And they all have no intention of giving up their guns. This guy on Kello was at a gun show, but they all wish that there would be more strict background checks so that you could have a better check on some of these mentally disturbed people who have gotten their hands on guns and then have gone out and done the mass shootings that we're all way too familiar with. And so I agree with Roger, right, that it's sort of out any move to do anything in the gun arena just invokes this reflexive action to go out and buy more guns and buy more ammunition and do all of this stuff. And I'm not sure what the impact is on the overall society. Hopefully all of those people are law-abiding, non-mentally disturbed people who are getting all of that, all those guns and all that ammunition.
Let's switch over to Keystone. Some news on that this week, moving forward a little bit, at least. with a statement of what we're going to do in the future if that President Obama isn't here anymore. Denise, you want to start off that one?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to hear the reporting on public radio about that, but I heard Public Utilities Commissioner Chris Nelson's comments this morning about the opponents. He said the commissioners begged them to stick to the criteria that the commission must consider when they decide whether or not to grant these permits. And in his opinion, and I haven't had a chance to review what the opponents of the pipeline submitted, but in his opinion, it was pretty clear that he didn't think they met that bar even by a little bit. And so that's an equal part of this debate. I don't think you can just say, well, the members of the Public Utilities Commission support the Keystone Pipeline. You have to remember they're bound by certain criteria. If they don't adhere to those criteria, they can easily be hauled into court in a lawsuit, and the state could end up paying a bunch of legal fees if TransCanada would decide to challenge that, which almost certainly they would. And so that it's a pretty predictable process in that regard if you look at arguments submitted, the burden of proof that has to be met, et cetera, et cetera. On the political side of things, it's much more interesting in that I predict that the Keystone Pipeline will be a major issue in the presidential race because you've already seen Hillary Clinton reverse her position on it from when she was Secretary of State, and she supported it when she's a candidate, having to appeal to the Democratic base, who broadly oppose the pipeline and are concerned about climate change. She's now against the pipeline, and I think it will only become a more prominent issue as we get into the 2016 cycle.
What does the average South Dakotan have to listen for on this topic next? We hear about it. It seems fairly complicated. What's significant for us to pay attention to in this debate, and what do we just let pass because it's meaningless?
Well, that's a really good question, Lori. Let me think about that. Now, I think this whole question of eminent domain, which is an emotional issue, we've got a lot of farmers who stand to have their land, you know, dug up by TransCanada if the next president decides to support this. You've got the issue of low gas prices now and oil fields in North Dakota shutting down, and no doubt that's also affecting the oil tar sands region up in Canada. If those gas prices come back up, I think you're going to see a much stronger push to get this pipeline approved. And if you look at it on the South Dakota dashboard, just yesterday we posted some numbers about the South Dakota economy. And for the longest stretch, South Dakota was just lagging so far behind North Dakota. And North Dakota was often number one or two in growth for personal income, gross domestic product, and on and on and on. That has completely reversed, where South Dakota is now number one in personal income, number two in GDP growth. And North Dakota and Wyoming and a lot of these other energy-dependent states are at the bottom, which I know is not directly related to the Keystone Pipeline, but it all ties together. And then you add in the factor of climate change, which everybody has their personal opinions on. And I think this issue will be with us for quite a long time.
Roger, what do you think that the average South Dakotan should be listening for in this particular conversation?
Well, I think until the federal government gives its okay for the pipeline, anything the states do is secondary at this point. So, my opinion is when the PUC go ahead and renewed their approval of this, it's just keeping it on life support until the federal government can give it the go-ahead. And then I think you'll see all the individual state issues coming into focus a little bit more.
Roger, you mentioned something earlier about pretty much everybody knows how South Dakotans are going to vote on something. So let's change the topic a little bit. The Rapid City Journal did a piece about five depressing statistics for South Dakota Democrats. They pulled their information from Smart Politics writer Eric Ostermeyer, who said, quote, "It's the bleakest outlook for South Dakota Democrats since the tail end of the Dwight Eisenhower administration." Any comments on that, Roger, as far as what does it mean to be a Democrat in the state right now?
I read the blog post on that, and it was pretty bleak if you're a Democrat. Some of the statistics were almost mind-boggling. Since statehood, Republicans have won 84% of our statewide elections here. Governor Dugard's last election was the most lopsided in state's history. We have a string of 10 governor elections that have gone to the Republicans, which is the longest streak in the country. It just seemed to go on and on and on with just amazing statistics. Right now, the Republicans hold a 58-12 majority in the House. And yes, that seems pretty bad, but actually back in the 40s, they shut out the Democrats for, I think, three consecutive sessions. There were no Democrats in the House. So we haven't quite hit rock bottom yet, but we're getting close.
What are the implications of that for state government?
Well, it means that the Republicans have no roadblocks in their way to do whatever they want, basically. But I think it goes beyond that. It has an effect on the whole demographics of the state. There's undoubtedly young college students in our state who are liberal Democrats, liberal-leaning Democrats anyway, and it must seem very difficult for them to choose South Dakota as where they want to live and work in that kind of environment. I think that's why you see a lot of our college graduates leaving to go to like Colorado or Minnesota or some area states that are a bit less Republican. But so far, you know, everything seems to be going fine. As we just heard, that South Dakota is doing well economically, and I'm sure the Republicans will say, if something's broken, don't fix it.
And Denise, it doesn't look as if the Democrats have a viable candidate to challenge John Thune. How significant is that?
Well, that is significant, but let me just add on to what Roger was saying about this ebb of the Democratic power. And what I see it as is the final erosion of what George McGovern worked so hard to put into place in the late 50s and 1960s. I was fortunate enough to interview him starting in the 90s and several times after that. And he told me the most amazing story, how he went around with a shoebox full of index cards, town after town after town, talking to local business people up and down Main Street, going door to door, basically, recruiting people to the Democratic Party. And this was at the time, as Roger said, when there were no Democrats in the South Dakota House of Representatives. He was able to convince people to come to meetings, to organize at the county level. And you saw ultimately that come to fruition, all of his work in the 1970s when South Dakota elected a Democratic governor and had Democratic majorities in the legislature. And you have just watched that slowly, slowly, slowly fade away over time. So that's a little bit of historical perspective. I think the Democrats need another George McGovern to go out and organize and do things like that. As far as the John Thune race, you know, he was unopposed last time. I think it actually hurts the candidate that doesn't have an opponent. They aren't as good as a candidate when they don't have to answer questions, when they don't have to debate, and they can just walk back into the office. I think any kind of a challenge, even if you don't think you can win, is important to the democratic process to raise issues, discuss issues, and get the other candidate on record on certain things.
Denise Ross is an editor with the Black Hills Knowledge Network and South Dakota Dashboard. Denise, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Lori.
And Roger is managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. Roger, thanks as well.
Thank you.